Today is Wednesday, October 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the full U.S. House of Representatives stands poised to vote on moving forward with the investigation of U.S. President Donald Trump. Also ahead, we learn what it's like for families waiting for positive identification a week after 39 bodies were found in the back of a truck in Britain. And
to allow us all to submit, as we must, in all humility, to the judgment of the electorate.
Britain will be going back to the polls this coming December. Those stories and more are all coming up next. The House impeachment inquiry is scheduled to hear from State Department Ukraine experts today, a day after a U.S. Army officer on the White House National Security Staff said he was so concerned that U.S. President Donald Trump urged Ukraine to investigate political opponents that he alerted his superiors. This comes as the full House of Representatives prepares to vote on formalizing the impeachment process. And after Alexander Vindman, a lieutenant colonel who served in Iraq and was later a diplomat, was the first U.S. official to testify who actually heard Trump's July 25th call with new Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Joining us now on the phone is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson with more details about Thursday's vote and the testimony today. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So this is something that Republicans have long been asking for, you know, a formalized vote authorizing in their minds the impeachment inquiry. And Speaker Nancy Pelosi outlined the so-called rules or the procedures that are coming down the pipe that everyone's going to vote on tomorrow. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. So we're actually about to start marking up that resolution in the next hour or so up here on Capitol Hill, but we've already seen the text. And what we do know is that it lays out the rules for the next step of the impeachment inquiry. And that's a key step because the House Democrats are going to take these hearings public very soon, probably in the next few weeks, by mid-November when the House comes back in session. That will be a key turning point that will help dismantle some of the Republican arguments that we've heard so far, complaining about the closed-door nature of the process, the fact that the American people aren't being read in on it, and that there's an overall lack of transparency on the part of the Democrats. And, of course, we've heard that they want a full House floor vote. They want to see that impeachment inquiry formalized. That's going to happen tomorrow.
And it should also be said that while the Republicans have said there's a lack of transparency, these are bipartisan committees that are conducting these hearings, and Republicans have been invited to the closed-door sessions.
That's absolutely right. You know, we're talking about three House committees that are inside those closed-door sessions, which have bipartisan membership, and many of the members, the Republicans, who forced their way into that classified area last week, were actually already allowed to be there in those depositions.
Now, this is coming a day after Alexander Vindman, who is a lieutenant colonel, who was on the call that is at the center of this impeachment inquiry. He testified yesterday and seemed to contradict a lot of the information that was presented in previous Republican talking points who were, you know, very adamantly defending the president. But we're scheduled to have two people additionally testify today from the State Department. What can you tell us about that planned testimony?
That's right. So the planned testimony didn't go off quite as planned because we had one of the witnesses fail to show up. And we really only have a little bit of information about that, just that Catherine Wheelbarger, who is the Acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, her deposition today has been postponed. However, we have other State Department officials, Catherine Croft and Christopher Anderson, who are testifying inside that SCIF.
VOA's congressional correspondent is Catherine Gibson. She's calling us from the Capitol Hill. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
The death of 39 migrants found in a refrigerated truck in Britain has reignited calls for efforts to tackle slavery in the nail salon sector, a common destination for trafficked Vietnamese. Most of the people discovered in the truck are believed to be from Vietnam, one of the top source countries for victims of modern slavery in Britain, accounting for about 10% of 7,000 suspected slaves referred to the government for support in 2018. Police are still investigating the case, and it is not clear why the victims were traveling to Britain. But it is well documented that some Vietnamese lured to Europe by promises of lucrative jobs end up exploited in illegal cannabis farms and cheap nail salons, which have proliferated across the country. Joining us now in the studio from VOA's Vietnamese service is reporter Thuc Pham. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Steve.
So, you know, the Vietnamese service has been following the story very closely, and I understand that one of the reporters was in contact with a family in Vietnam who has a family member missing, and they're concerned that they may be involved in this case.
Right. We interviewed the family on Monday, and the father, he is very concerned that his son, a 33-year-old son, is missing and might be among the victims.
Now, did the father know why his son was trying to get to Britain?
He told us that his son traveled to France, and he stayed there for a month, and he had a job working in a restaurant, washing dishes, things like that, and he complained that the work is so hard for him, so he tried to go to Britain where he can work in the nail industry because doing nail service is less labor intensive, less hard, and he can earn more money.
When was the last time that the family had contact with their son?
The last time they contacted each other was on the 21st, so just 2 days before
the bodies
truck
were
found. Yeah, discovered.
Now, initially, there were a lot of reports that, you know, perhaps the individual were Chinese. Then the authorities backtracked that and said, no, there's possibly some Vietnamese. As far as we know, the authorities have not made any positive identification as to who was in the truck. But has the family been, what kind of contact has the family had between, you know, the Vietnamese government reaching out to the United Kingdom government to move that process forward?
Yep. So what we learned so far is that the Ministry of Public Security in Vietnam, which is the police force, already came to the location in Vietnam and collected information from 22 different families who provide hair and other samples for DNA testing. And the British side also submitted to the Vietnamese side four sets of documents on four individuals. So that's all this information that they exchanged so far.
We only have about 20 seconds left here. Is the family trying to pursue other avenues of reaching out to see if the son is just out of communication?
They did contact a group called Viet Home, which is a group of Vietnamese people in Britain. But so far, they have not learned new information yet.
Thuc Pham is from VOA's Vietnamese service. Thank you so much for stopping by.
You're welcome.
Chilean President Sebastian Piñera says ongoing protests have led him to call off two major international summits that his country had been scheduled to host. Piñera announced on Wednesday that the Asia-Pacific Summit, or APEC, which was set for November 16th and 17th, and the COP25 Global Climate Gathering planned for December 2nd through the 13th, are being canceled. The APEC summit was scheduled to bring together 20 world leaders. It was also expected that U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping would meet on the sidelines of the APEC summit to sign phase one of a trade deal which aims to de-escalate tensions between the world's two top economies. Chile has seen 12 days of massive protests to demand greater economic equality and better public services in a South American country long seen as an economic success story. At least 18 people have been killed, 7,000 arrested, and Chilean businesses hit with losses of around $1.4 billion. The capital city's metro transport suffered nearly $400 million in damage. With Panera's popularity at an all-time low, the Chileans are calling for new protests, and the United Nations was sending a team to investigate allegations of human rights abuses. The cancellation of the trade summit caught the Trump administration by surprise, according to a White House official releasing a statement. The official said Washington learned about the decision from news reports and is seeking additional information. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists claims to have identified a region in southern Africa as the birthplace of all modern humans. Researchers say they have evidence that the ancestral homeland of all living humans was located south of the greater Zambezi River Basin region, which includes northern Botswana, into Namibia to the west, and Zimbabwe to the east. The region held what was once Africa's largest ever lake system, Lake Makatikati. Geologist Dr. Andy Moore from Rhodes University says before modern humans appeared there some 200,000 years ago, shifts in underlying tectonic plates caused the massive lake to drain, creating a vast wetland which allowed our ancestors to thrive for over 70,000 years. The researchers also proposed that human migrations from the region some 110 to 130,000 years ago were triggered by changes in Africa's climate. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Lisa Schlein reports the United Nations Refugee Agency says more than 12,000 Syrian refugees have fled to Iraq in less than 2 weeks to escape Turkey's military onslaught in Kurdish-controlled areas in northeastern Syria.
The UN Refugee Agency reports it is scaling up its humanitarian operation in Iraq in response to the deepening humanitarian refugee crisis on both sides of the Syrian-Iraqi border. The UNHCR says since the last influx of Syrian refugees nearly 2 weeks ago, more than 12,000 people have crammed into the recently opened Bab Irash camp. More than 800 other refugees are sheltering at the Gawilan transit site. It notes both places are about 150 kilometers east of the border. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mehechit says his agency is working with Iraqi authorities to reunite the newly arrived refugees with family members living in Iraq's Kurdistan region.
UNHCR is supporting the response led by the local authorities, and it is working closely with them to ready other locations in the event that both sites reach their capacity. Refugee families at both locations are receiving the same services and humanitarian assistance. This includes hot meals, transportation, registration, shelter, and protection services.
Turkey began its so-called Operation Peace Spring against Kurdish-led forces in Syria on October 9th. The offensive began after the U.S. Trump administration announced it was withdrawing U.S. troops who have been allied with the Syrian Kurds in the region. The Kurds, who have lost thousands of people in fighting against Islamic State militants, have accused Washington of betraying them. The UNHCR reports nearly 180,000 Syrian Kurds, including some 80,000 children, have been displaced since the start of the Turkish assault. Dozens of civilians reportedly have been killed. The UN estimates 1.3 million people in the region are in need of humanitarian assistance. The UN Refugee Agency reports women and children comprise around three-quarters of the Syrian refugees in the two campsites in Iraq. It says many are in need of psychosocial counseling. UNHCR spokesman Mahechit says agency teams are conducting protection monitoring, child protection, and working to identify unaccompanied children and people with specific needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United States military says there are now fewer than 150 Islamic State fighters left in Libya. That's a huge reduction from last year when the AFRICOM official said Islamic State had as many as 750 members in Libya. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has those details.
Speaking exclusively to VOA, U.S. Africa Command's Director of Public Affairs, Colonel Chris Carnes, said the military saw a regeneration of Islamic State forces and, with coordination from the Libyan government, decided to strike.
So they were gathering in camps where they were doing some of the basic training and starting to do some of the recruiting, and consequently airstrikes were conducted. So 43 Islamic State fighters have been taken out of Libya permanently. Right now, when you look at the numbers, it's under 150.
The deteriorating security situation allowed the militants to expand their presence in ungoverned spaces. Troops affiliated with the Government of National Accord are battling forces led by strongman Khalifa Haftar, killing hundreds of people caught in the middle of the fight this year.
Our concern was that with the civil war, these terrorist groups, in particular ISIS, would look to leverage this opportunity to grow, to recruit, to train, and create additional chaos in a situation that is already chaotic.
Islamic State in the country's south has claimed responsibility for several deadly attacks against Libyan civilians and military personnel. But the group is now a fraction of what it was in Libya in 2016, when there were an estimated 4,000 to 6,000 fighters. The U.S. military carried out about 500 airstrikes against the Islamic State fighters that year, condensing them to a small stronghold around the coastal town of Sirte before their ultimate defeat. Carnes said that, overall, AFRICOM has seen just a trickle of Islamic State come to Africa from the Middle East this year, rather than the flood of fighters many feared would saturate the continent after the terror group's territorial defeat in Iraq and Syria in March. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
British lawmakers have approved a timetable for new elections this past Tuesday. Prime Minister Boris Johnson made his case for the new election in the House of Commons.
We are left with no choice but to go to the country to break free from this impasse and to allow us all to submit as we must in all humility to the judgment of the electorate.
As the European Union agreed to a third delay to the divorce that was originally supposed to take place on March 29th, the United Kingdom, its parliament, and its electorate remain divided on how or indeed whether to go ahead with Brexit. Joining us now on the phone to help break everything down is our reporter in London, Mr. Henry Ridgewell. Henry, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So Mr. Johnson says that this is, you know, an impasse in the House of Commons to try and get Brexit done, but Theresa May couldn't get Brexit done. He couldn't get Brexit done. Is this election going to get Brexit done?
Who knows is the short answer to that question. It's another roll of the dice from Boris Johnson. This will be the third election in 4 years in Britain, and it will be the first one to be held in December for almost 100 years for very good reasons, that it's dark, it's cold, people tend to have more illnesses, and so the turnout tends to be lower. So that's the risk that Boris Johnson is taking with this, but it shows just how big that impasse in Parliament is.
What kind of risk is at stake for Boris Johnson himself? I mean, he is really new to the role of Prime Minister, taking over for Theresa May. He promised that Brexit was going to happen tomorrow, October 36. He'd rather be dead in a ditch than ask for an extension. Here he is asking, had to ask for an extension and now a new election. Is his position as Prime Minister secure? Should his party win?
If his party wins a clear majority, I think his position is safe and he will push ahead with the Brexit deal that he agreed with the European Union. And Brexit is very likely to take place on January the 31st or sooner. Mr. Johnson believes, and his supporters believe, he's a good campaigner. He won the campaign to be London mayor. He's a well-established politician and well-liked among members of his own party. The problem is, we don't know how popular he is across the country, and we've seen with the polls before, with Theresa May's election, as you mentioned, in 2017, when the Conservatives were double ahead in the polls, and then it ended up in a hung parliament, with the Conservatives only gaining a few more percentage points than the opposition Labour Party. So it's really very much in doubt. I've mentioned those problems with a winter election. And, of course, there's also the problem of the Brexit Party, headed by Nigel Farage. they could easily shave off a few votes from the Conservatives, particularly given that deadline of the 31st of October has now been missed. And Labour, the opposition, are pretty unpredictable. Jeremy Corbyn is probably not as popular as he once was, but he could easily drive a campaign onto key issues like the NHS or schools funding. So there are so many unknowns in this, and we've seen the volatility of the electorate is so high, it is a big risk for Boris Johnson, but he thinks that it's the only way he can move forward and get Brexit done and try to create a legacy for himself as Prime Minister.
Henry Ridgewell was in London. Thank you so much for your time today.
Good to be with you again.
It has been an unconventional road to Game 7 of the World Series for the local Washington Nationals. Seizing the October spotlight he longed for as a youngster, pitcher Strasburg, and another postseason gem in the ninth inning Tuesday night as the Nationals were able to win and the game against the Houston Astros 7-2 to tie the Fall Classic 3 games apiece. The wild card Nationals have largely matched the heavily favored Astros throughout the series, and now it's on to a final winner-take-all Game 7 tonight. And joining us now in the studio is the host of VOA Sunny Side of Sports. Sporty greetings, Sunny.
Sporty greetings, Steve. Great to be on International Edition.
So here we are, Game 7. I didn't think that we would actually be here since the Astros are favored. They are favored 1.5 runs last night, but the Nationals, you know, took it. And they took it decisively.
I think you used the phrase the unconventional road to Game 7. This World Series, this 115th World Series, unconventional in many respects, especially in regards to home field advantage.
True.
So far, the home team has not won a game in this
World
Series.
Not a single one.
Just to recap, the Nationals won the first 2 games in Houston. Then the Astros came here to Washington, won 3 in a row. The Nationals won again in Houston last night, 7-2. And you mentioned Steven Strasburg, one of the ace pitchers for the Nationals. He put his name in the record books last night, Steve. He became the first pitcher in Major League history to go 5-0 in a single postseason. That means he won 5 games during the playoffs this season. I don't think he's going to pitch tonight. But congratulations to Steven
Strasburg. That's an incredible feat. You know, one of the things I like about baseball is that it truly is a game of statistics. And one of the things that caught me by surprise last night, and I think speaks to the veracity of both these teams, is that if you go back to the beginning of the baseball season and the abysmal start that the Nationals had and how they got here today. But there's a point in May, and since that point in May, the Astros and the Nationals have had the same record up until last night. So in a way, it's very fitting that we are in Game 7 and that we have the two teams with essentially the same record coming down to it in.
They mirror themselves in some way. They both have great pitching staffs, the Astros and the Nationals. Tonight in Game 7, it'll be Max Scherzer on the mound for Washington against Zach Greinke for Houston. Max was supposed to pitch Game 5, Steve, but he pulled out because of some neck spasms. So I know Nationals fans, including myself, are hoping he'll be healthy tonight. But I think it's been a very exciting series in many ways. You mentioned that poor start by the Nationals. I certainly didn't see them advancing to the World Series. They had to win a wild card game just to advance. So they've really been a storybook team in many ways.
Really quickly, we have about 30 seconds left here. You know, what are the odds makers saying about tonight? Is Astros still favored, or have the Nationals turned the tide a little bit?
I haven't checked with my bookie in Vegas, but I don't know. I think they're evenly matched right now. I really do. I think it's sort of one of those 50-50 games. So far, as I mentioned, home field hasn't really amounted
made anything. Well, thank you very much, Sonny, for coming by and letting us, pick your brain about tonight's game. You can, of course, listen to the Sunny Side of Sports here on VOA Monday through Friday at 16:30 UTC. Thanks again, Sonny.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer, Rob McLean, and managing editor, Paul Alexander, thank you very much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth news coverage and world events at our website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.